just wait for that to happen because I knew that was slippery.
Linux top. Okay, go ahead.
Now, this runway was extremely narrow. It was just as wide as the Cub landing gear. Now, Machiko and Watanabe were the only two after 14,300 foot turnaround. There's a very delicate situation where if you don't use the momentum of the airplane to get lined up on your takeoff run, you're in trouble. Therefore, with this aerodrome that was barely 2 feet wider than the skis that they had gracefully stamped down, it was in the right direction for the takeoff, down the slope in a straight line. I didn't dare land on the runway because I would certainly be stuck in the deep snow as I turned to try to get back on the runway. Therefore, I landed in the snow, the powder 5 foot snow to the side of the runway, about the 14,200 foot level, used the momentum and made my turn within 150 feet and came out on the runway, luckily, pointed right down the mountain. And then I was all set up for the takeoff on a packed runway that had set for several days.
Yeah.
This is why I didn't land on the runway.
All right. Now, the question is, you've heard this thing. The question is, do you feel that that's an adequate description with, after I rewrite it and incorporate the changes we've got in the case?
Yeah.
Do you
sure
think
do.
That this is an adequate description of the Sequito?
Right. Any more to bomb everybody down.
Okay, I've got tapes on the balance of what happened. You took the bodies back to South Sequito. And
in one fell swoop on the turbo job.
I've got that on tape. I just had it written again. I've got maybe 2 or 3 more pages now in the chapter. Okay. So the reason I asked that question is because at this point I'm not sure anymore whether I'm going to be able to see that lousy diary because Washburn might have it.
No, but looky, don't sweat it because I'm going to fire a letter to Machiko myself and I know I'm going to get an answer.
You're more optimistic than I am.
Well, I'm optimistic, you know.
Anyway,
I bet you a milkshake that she gives me an answer.
Look at while you're writing, you were asking for a couple of pictures.
I do that.
Boy, I thought you did that weeks ago.
No, no. Listen, that was so touchy that I didn't want to bother. I mean, she wrote me some letters there I didn't even answer myself.
She had what?
She wrote me a series of letters, none of which I answered. I have been waiting for the right words. They're just too touchy. So I'll compose something and I will fire off a composed letter. I think I've got some of them. I think I can phrase it better. Because she's a very,
Well, look at, if you can.
Like I say, I thought you wrote long ago to get the pictures. Let's shut this thing off.
Yeah. Knowing they were, who the hell?
All right, all I'm saying is that she had come to the realization that there's a darn good possibility that these three companions of hers were dead at the boat.
No, not that. Well, okay.
She had considered that possibility at this time pretty strongly. You know, that's what I say. That's all I'm saying right now. Okay.
Could you say it more gracefully, like been involved in a serious accident or something?
Why?
Because everybody that has an accident don't get wiped out. Not everyone.
Oh.
Well, you ought to set a record.
A lot of them do.
Yeah, but to say that this takes some finesse, some delicacy in say involved, it would sound better and cushion the shock a little more.
To
you
who?
Say
cushion the shock to who?
Well, to outright say I give you up for dead isn't
she's not
right.
That isn't what I said. I'm just saying that she by now, after she climbed to the top of the mountain, came back down
She, one, knew that something had happened beyond a doubt.
All right,
now wait a minute. Let me finish saying what I'm going to say. She also, by this time, must have considered the fact that if she can't find him, they must have been involved in what you call a serious accident.
There you go.
All right.
That's
now,
good.
What did she say to herself then? Oh, but there's no possibility they were killed. They must be alive up there someplace. Bull. She thought to herself, okay, now, if they got an avalanche, Jesus, I hope they're still alive. And in saying that, she recognized and admitted to herself the possibility that they may not be. That's all I'm saying, Don. She wasn't a totally unrealistic person, I'm sure. She's an intelligent individual. She's working with handicapped kids. She's got all the cards in front of her. She knows what's going on. And by this time, she must have begun to stop and say to herself, well, geez, I surely hope not, but maybe they were in a fatal accident somewhere like this.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Well, don't confront, you know, to say somebody's dead is too much like throwing cold water in their face when you don't know for sure. The fatal accident route sounds better. Possible.
Okay.
We have 4 ounces of cold water. Go ahead.
The wind cracked lips, she talked to me. Okay, she's back at 7,000 feet. Now, did she radio you at that time? When she got back from the solo climb? After she realized that she couldn't find him, she beat out, depressed.
She skied clear back down. Wait a minute. Here's what happened. Hey, here is exactly what happened. She did ski, solo ski, clear from the northeast fork of the Keelson Glacier at the base of the Beaten Bar Route, from the base of the Beaten Bar Route, clear back all over that tremendous ice field, all these terrible ice holes and all. There's some terrible country to cross. She made it, and then she called me at the 7,000 foot level. Now, this is after we've been on several searches, you understand, of course. Because as soon as the helicopter set her off, within hours, we had her up in the air. I was in the air constantly. The weather was not all that bad after this big storm. I'd spent a number of flights, especially to look. I spent 7 hours in the Super Cub alone, not counting innumerable trips in the area with high-altitude photography.
Funny you never saw her.
That's a big mountain.
I did, on several occasions, see
fresh tracks going from the camp up the face. The rocks are black and orange. The park as they were are orange. The faces are blue and green.
You didn't know she was climbing at all. She didn't say she was going to when you left her.
Here's the thing. She had told me that she had a whole bunch of gear to bring from the 9,000 foot camp. In the meanwhile, she hoped to meet the party coming down. See? So it was perfectly natural that she should disappear with her ski tracks heading up the glacier, which are easy to follow. And they went clear to the camp, so I knew she didn't fall in an ice hole. So, anyway, here, I have something figured out there that was. When she came, here's the thing that I had figured out. After she did this solo deal and was unsuccessful, she returned to the 7,000 foot level. Yeah, that's right. Now, here's what she said. We're back at the 7,000 foot level. You're okay up to this point. Here's what happened. Exactly. She says, land me near the 9,000 foot base of Beaten Bar Ridge. And I said, I'll land you as close as I can, but not right in front of your camp. So I took the Super Cub and I landed at the forks of the East Fork of the Kehiltna Glacier, about 8,600 foot elevation. The following Day it was, I believe. At least a day lapse.
And after she got back and radioed, you went for the next day?
For weather, okay. For the early morning crust. And now, these hot days, you can't, don't dare land in the afternoon. Okay, I used the exasperating 3 or 4 o'clock early morning hours of a clear day with the crust. And I landed on the Serac at about 8650 there at the, it's a pressure ridge between the East Fork and the main glacier, and it's steep. And it gave me the opportunity for a loaded takeoff. In the meanwhile, she had returned back up there again and relayed her gear from the base of the Breton Ball approach, clear back to the 86 level, which is the forks in the main and the East Fork, the Northeast Fork of the Gillen Glacier. And I took her in 3 loads back to the 7,000 foot level. Oh, yeah, you got that.
I think I got that. Okay, but all right, now look at, give me a figure on between the time that you first took her, when the helicopter
dropped her off,
got her buddy and her, took her down to 7,000 feet.
Got
and
it.
Then you then immediately came back in, picked her up. You went up and flew around that day.
Yes,
2.5 hours that day.
Yeah.
All right. You brought her back down to 7,000 because she wanted to stay there and see if she could find it.
And wait for him and hopefully...
Okay, now from that point on, you didn't see her again until after she made the solo flight, right?
I saw her track.
All right, but you
which
didn't see her, did you?
Listen, I want to say...
How long from the time that you left her after you took her around the mountain until she got on the radio after she'd made her solo climb?
God, it must have been about a week.
All right, that's all I got to know, period. That's all I have to know.
In the meanwhile, I was looking for signs of her.
Fine.
She's one bitty speck on the huge massive.
No problem. Okay. Okay. She came back down now after her solo climb. Alleged solo climb. All right, now, through wind-cracked lips, she talked hysterically with Sheldon. Was she hysterical with it?
No, not quite. She's a rational kid. She's a solid citizen. She's not one of these.
Don, that's not the picture you painted on the other tapes, man.
Well,
you
if
called
I
her a shock word case when
well,
she got
I,
down off the mountain. Now, you know,
well,
it's damn tough for me to write this. If, you know,
well,
you're,
it
you're
affected her nerves,
opposite.
But she had a tremendous good nervous system.
All right, so what did she say? How did she act when she talked to you on the radio? What did you hear when you listened? What did she say? Not in words, but what was she like? What was she talking about? Did she tell you she'd gone up looking for her? What did she say?
See, part of the time, Roberta takes the message. I get the gist of the message, to come pick her up, to go reconnaissance plan. I'm not there listening to the radio all the time.
Okay.
I don't know what the radio contact was, except to give us the news that she wanted me to come in airplane, take her back as close as we could land at the 9,300-400 foot level Breton Bar Ridge, which I said, fine.
Yeah.
When I got the message, I think Roberta intercepted that one. I'm busy flying.
Yeah, okay. Okay. And Sheldon promised that he would be there as soon as he could. Okay.
And listen, it was probably the next morning that I made it under a beautiful condition. No wind.
Okay, we
3, 4
got
o'clock
that
in the morning.
Sheldon met them. We're waiting Michiko at the 7,000 foot strip. But she didn't turn to you.
No.
Met her at 8,000.
Wait a minute.
Remember now, we already got this on here. There's no sense going back to it.
Yeah.
It burns up tape.
Yeah, well,
so
well you got that straight as far as it is. Let's
right,
go on
no
ahead.
Sweat. Okay. All right, now here's where I got screwed up. Now here's where I bring in where you touch her up.
Say, wait a minute. Here's one thing that I don't want to confuse you with detail, but this is not a too confusing. You recall that I took her to Talkeetna for a break. I think that when she called for an airplane to go up to the area of the 9,000 foot camp, and this is important, that at that time I was in a wrong airplane, the conditions of the snow was wrong, I said to her, let you stay at Col Roberta or whatever, for her to stay at the 7,000 foot level, and it is at this time we went to Talkeetna for the break. This is after the climb, after the climb, and before the pickup of their gear. Then, wait a minute, I'm piecing it together, this is the way it was. Then, as this was an intermission between these two facts, was that I got her on an inbound flight from another hall, freight hall in the area. She had a short intermission at Talkeetna on the next available ideal condition. Then we took the Super Cub, and wait, listen to this. We landed at this 8,650 foot level, and she had in the meanwhile relayed her gear, which was at the 9,300 foot level, to this particular location within.
Before you took her to Talkeetna.
Right, for the break. That's the way that was, and that's the way it is. Now you got that figured.
Okay. All right, now, like I say, I erroneously worded it the other way.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's skip over
that's
that.
Not surprising.
Okay, we really gave the mountain a going over. Now, this is just a description of when you did take her up.
Mm-hmm.
This will be moved ahead.
Yeah, yeah.
Rewrite. Quote, we really gave, now this is right off the page, we really gave the mountain a going over for about 2.5 hours.
Right.
We could see the expedition flag at the summit.
We could see several expedition flags. We
okay, but you said the expedition flag.
Well, we spent a lot of time
trying to identify. I got about 3 inches of tape for you worn out listening to that, too.
Yeah, well, look, another thing, we could see what may have been a shelter on the summit. Nobody.
Black plastic.
Yeah, right. And
okay, but you said on the other tape, you could see the expedition flag.
She thought she recognized her expedition flag.
Okay, on the summit. And knew that the three girls made it to the top.
We think that's the way it is.
Because you said you knew from head on the top, right? It may have been, who the hell?
No one else left black plastic shelter up there.
It may have been the sight of the flag that clinched the Taquita girl's mind, and she must have become. Okay, this is again part of this first area. All right, Sheldon and Michiko Sakita saw nothing more other than the possible expedition flag and the piece of black plastic.
Well, we saw other expeditions in the area.
Right, but I'm talking about you saw nothing more of the Sakita expedition.
Right.
All right, Sheldon and Michiko Sakita saw nothing more, and Sheldon once more marveled at the strength that the tiny climber possessed. He'd already been through an exhausting ordeal. And now, after 2.5 hours, tiring hours, flying on oxygen.
Yeah.
She on oxygen.
Yeah.
She was reluctant to abandon the search. Sheldon knew that there was no other choice this time. Well, both fuel and oxygen were getting low. And he placed, now, you were in the Cessna at this time? Placed the Super Cub in a long, gradual glide on a general southeasterly heading, a course which would take them to this strip of Talkeetna. You took her back at that point, didn't you? Or, no, this is what's correct. You took her to the rest. This is where I'm trying to get you back to Talkeetna, where she goes for her rest. And you did that when you went in to help her relay gear. So you rewrite that. I've got that all now.
Well, the relay of the gear.
Part of the whole
look here,
area.
Wait a minute. The relay of the gear was the last act. That
right, I know that.
Except, go ahead.
Okay, but you can start to see now how one little error will screw you up through the whole chapter.
You're doing great. Go on.
Okay, quote, a huge press was on. Michiko was on the phone more than she was off it. A figure of speech, obviously. There were calls from everywhere. The press and half a dozen papers. Relatives, loved ones of the climbers and the Japanese embassy. I couldn't help but notice the trend of the conversation from both my heart and Roberta's went out for the real thing. Now that's what you said on tape.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, unquote. The responsibility that the girl had assumed as leader of the expedition to McKinley now became a stifling burden.
Yeah.
The Japanese embassy demanded that she be personally responsible for all expenses incurred, both the expedition and the rescue and recovery of the climbers from the mountains. Michiko Sakita found that she was bound not only financially, but morally,
for unless she could comply with the demands of the embassy and the people of her country, she would not be allowed to return home.
That's right. That's pretty strong.
And now, time began to pass with almost confusing rapidity. Sheldon had taken his first prolonged look on the, now here again was going to be arrogant because of this. And now time began to pass with almost confusing rapidity. Sheldon had taken his first prolonged look on the same day, July 12th, that the news of the girl, the missing girl, became public knowledge. Now, that would have been the day that, well, that would have been the day you brought her in for rest.
Well, we knew something was up before then.
Well, how about the newspapers? When did they start picking it up?
Listen, who knows? But you can check that out.
Oh,
is it important?
Done. You can check it out. You can't believe anything you read in the newspaper.
Well, right.
You can read an article like he got you rescuing somebody on the 12th and you actually got him on the 9th.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. I wouldn't bind myself into a tight time frame, period. Would you?
Well, this isn't tight, Tom. Well, it is, really. That's
yeah, but...
Okay.
All
right, that's good.
Later. I would say later.
All right. He was at that time servicing several crews on the mountain. When he failed to find any trace of them, he overflew several of his expeditions and dropped notes.
I did.
Telling the climbers to be on the lookout for them. The newspapers got that right. It's the first thing I found so far. But they had correct. The weather on the mountain was not running through the form, and it offered comparatively good flying.
Good.
When he could, Sheldon was aloft, and at these times, he flew as long as either the weather or his fuel and oxygen tanks allowed.
Right.
Quote, when Machiko and I flew that first day, I concentrated on the east approach because I estimated that if the 3 gals had been blown off the mountain, the wind, which had been from the west, would have caused a fall in that direction.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I half expected that the area that had killed the Wilcox crew would be where we find the Sepita crew.
Right.
Okay, unquote. The U.S. Air Force had circled the mountain with a C-130 on several occasions, but due to the fact that their helicopters did not function at the summit, none were pressed into service. Now, this is mostly from here on. I've got the stuff from Geneva. Okay. Sheldon learned later that the 3 girls had been seen by, how does Gershman?
Dr. Gershman.
Gershman? How do you spell it?
G-E-R-S-T-S-H-M-A-N.
G-E-R-S-T-S?
Gershman.
All right, how do you spell it? G-E-R-S.
Roberta's got his name in our file.
Okay.
But that's
where
was
he from?
Portland, Seattle area.
At the 19,000 foot level in Denali Pass.
Right.
And just beneath the summit.
Not Denali Pass. That's over the Archdeacon's Tower. Denali Pass is 1,000 feet below, 1,000 terrible feet below. And now, this is over the Archdeacon's Tower at 19,000 or 2 for Gershman's party coming down. Kostama and Gershman.
Okay.
And
Gershman
party.
And his companions had tried desperately to convince the girl that they were climbing into a dangerous weather condition, but were unsuccessful. In a statement to Sheldon, Gershman said that he was appalled that the girl did not carry sleeping bags, and they were very obviously making a dash for the summit. In addition to the fact that they carried no sleeping bag, or for that matter, packs.
No. They carried, they don't carry packs. They carry these rucksacks with a one-day's food in them. They don't carry it by hand because their hands are full of ropes and ice packs. They carry rucksacks, not packsacks. Different.
Sheldon's early appraisal of the flaw in the Michiko Sepita party was now a chilling reality. It was due primarily to his conversation with Gershman that he had decided that the girls were now somewhere near the summit. Did you talk with Gershman?
I dropped Gershman's notes on the way down the mountain.
But you didn't know that he had talked to them until long after this thing was over?
No, until he got down to the pickup lab, which didn't take him too long.
So you knew before you even found him, you had talked to Gershman.
Yeah, Gershman was out before we found him.
Yep. Good. Yeah. Rolling on here. Rolling along, during the 10-day period, that followed the first day's search with Michiko on board, Sheldon became obsessed with wanting to find the girl.
Right.
Years of experience looking for not only climbers, but any manner of things on the mountain had taught him patience. He knew that each day he flew could bring success, for the snows of McKinley or any other mountain are constantly shifting. With the changing landscape below, each day made the search a new one. But Chico Watanabe's husband arrived in Talkeetna, and each day paced aimlessly near Sheldon's hangar and office. Now that's a question of the ladies.
Right.
He said the guy was like a lost soul.
Right.
Watching the sky to the northwest and waiting for news of the lost one. By the afternoon of July 22nd, Sheldon had spoken with Ray Genet about the search. And though the Frenchman was due to join a climb already in progress.
Swiss. Don't call Genet a Frenchman. That's a sacrilege.
His name's French.
He's a Swiss.
One of his parents must have been French.
Oh, they're all.
Genet is French.
Sacked up over there. Go ahead. Call him, don't call him a Frenchman.
Okay.
You know, Isaac.
By the afternoon of July 22nd, Sheldon had spoken with Ray Genet about the search, and though the French, the Swissman, Swiss, how do you say Swiss? Swisser, was due to join the climb already in progress on the mountain. He agreed to help in any way that he could. His first assistance came in the form of sound advice. With an almost casual shrug, Genet recalls Fred. The events that followed. Quote, Watanabe was wandering around there and it was really fast. So I said, well, heck, the best way to look really good is with a helicopter. So I called the Japanese consul.
Yeah.
I asked them if they would pay for a helicopter. At that time, nobody really figured that it was a rescue anymore. And I figured we would be looking for bodies. The Air Force wasn't much help, if any, because their limit with their helicopter was about 14,000 feet, whereas the Army had machines that could fly to the summit. But since it was no longer a search for survivors, they could not help us. I figured that a private helicopter would be our best bet. Genet explained to the consulate why he felt the use of a helicopter would be best at that time, and offered to ride the chopper and supply his expert knowledge of the terrain and the search. He was then informed that another team of Japanese climbers was being staged from Japan and would arrive at a later date. Quote, I said, well, that doesn't make too much sense because they would all be strangers to the mountain and too much time would be used up waiting for them. The longer we waited, the better the chances would be that the bodies, wherever they were, would be snowed over and never found. The Japanese consulate reluctantly agreed to Genet's plan, but stated that the limit for a helicopter charter would be 7 hours of flying time. Genet then contacted GA Helicopter Service in Anchorage. The race arranged for use of an Alouette II, a turbo supercharged machine capable of high altitude operation. The pilot who finally agreed to fly to McKinley had never been above 10,000 feet after the first man scheduled, quote, turned up sick, end quote. Quote, we started the search in the most likely area, taking a wide swing around the summit, and then swinging back and forth over the slope, gradually losing altitude until we got to just above 15,000 feet. It was here that I spotted something that at the moment only looked like tiny dots. Genet asked the pilot to turn around and make another approach, this time at a little lower altitude, which he did. Quote, as we hovered there, I could see that it was part of the body sticking out of the snow. Genet carefully marked the spot in his mind and told the chopper pilot to return to Talkeetna. They had been in the air several hours, and on the way back, Genet calculated that if they had been required to continue the search for another half hour, they would have reached the charter limit placed upon the flight by the Japanese consul. Sheldon met Genet in Talkeetna and quickly learned about the apparent fate of the three girls. Quote, from what Ray told me, I could visualize the route that the fall had taken, and it was down at least a 70% grade. Hell, a guy could parachute down that slope, and it ends almost exactly 1,000 feet above my strip of 14.3.
Right.
we figured that the gal had made the summit and then got caught in a sudden storm accompanied by tremendous winds. They could probably see the tents of my other people down at the 14,000 foot level, and maybe thought that they could take a shortcut down to them. Whatever happened to them, they either fell or were blown down the slope and tumbled at least 4,000 feet. Unquote. When asked if he considered the Japanese girls experienced enough for the mountains, Janae's laconic reply carries a world of wisdom. Quote, what is experience? On the mountain, you learn all the time. Unquote. The following day, Sheldon loaded Janae, Marley, and Titus, Michiko, Sakita, and the Watanabe woman husband into his 180 and flew them to the 10,000 foot remote pass. Within the park boundary, Janae had asked for and received special permission to land here, since this was a mission to retrieve the bodies of the girls as opposed to the routine start of the climb. Prior to leaving Talkeetna, he had been less than enthusiastic about Watanabe accompanying his group for very obvious reasons. After the arrival at 10,000 feet, which is Sheldon's maximum safe operational altitude of the 180.
Now I run him up to 12.5. Change that.
12.5 with the 180?
I flew the Air Force full test to 12.5 on the south face of McKinley at the base of the Kissin Ridge.
Yeah.
Don't put 10 on that.
Okay.
And besides that turbo job, who knows, you might take it to 16,000.
Janae and the others immediately climbed to the 14,300 foot level. And Sheldon's Super Cub landing strip.
Right.
Where they joined Janae's expedition.
Right. And the reason they didn't land up there to start with, they wanted to become acclimatized from the 10,000 to 14,000.
Hang tight, you got it in the next 3 seconds. The climb to this point took the party of two full days. It consisted of 2 18-hour climbing sessions. Once at 14.3, they were in a position to reach the bodies, the location of which only they knew at this point.
Right.
Janae describes the actual recovery with clinical detachment. So, Titus stayed at 14,300, and we started the climb at 15.5 with a crew of 9, including myself.
Wait, 15.5? They were at 15.3. They started to climb from the 14.3.
Okay.
Or from 14.5 up the face. Here, change that. Because they were at 15.3, from 14.3 to 15.3. In other words, they had a 1,000-foot climb up. Go ahead.
Okay.
So it makes a difference because they couldn't start to climb higher than they were because they were lower. The people are hanging up here at 15.3. They got to my 14.3 turnaround,
okay,
and they've got 1,000 feet to go, right?
With a crew of 9, including myself, Michiko, Sakita, and Watanabe were with us, and we reached the Seracs in a relatively short time. It took us some time to get the bodies entangled, and I knew then that they had fallen a long distance. They were rolled up in the climbing rope that they were tied together with, and several shoes had been lost. We used this queen to slide the bodies down to the 14.3 level, and it took 3 guys for each body. Unquote. With the bodies recovered and resting at 14,300, Janae explained to Michiko, Sakita, and Watanabe how and where to tramp down a runway for Sheldon, who would be arriving on July 27th.
Weather permitting.
Marley and Titus, along with Janae's expedition, then continued up the mountain. As they climbed, they kept watch over the 2 Japanese and also watched Sheldon land on the 27th. Janae had been in radio contact with the pilot over a small short wave set that he carried for the purpose whenever on the mountain. Marley and Titus, Janae's vivacious girlfriend, remembered that Sheldon chose to land next to the runway that had been tamped out for reasons of his own, and grimaces at the wasted effort. Quote, I'd rather climb the mountain any day than tramp down a runway, unquote. Whatever Sheldon's reasons for the off-runway landing, his arrival was as precise as ever, and he immediately relayed the bodies one at a time in his Super Cub down to the landing site at 10,000 feet, where he would later land the set to retrieve.
At 7,000. I picked them all out. I got the whole...
I caught the 7,000 rather than 10. Yeah. Okay. Okay, well, that's as far as I got. There's very little left to write. It's just a wrap-up of the thing now. Okay.